was it like in the early 50s? We hear just anecdotally that was maybe the greatest single period of flight test because of all the developments were made in the early 50s.
Yeah, well, the golden years, yeah. Well, we did a lot of that at Wright Field, and a lot of the experimental stuff, in-house stuff. But when you went out there, you were going to fly somebody's brand new airplane or some kind of new engine or something like that. And it was just so important to have that valuable resource there.
Right. You flew scores and scores and scores of different airplanes. Did you ever have a favorite?
A favorite airplanes? I got three. A P-51, of course, because it got me through the war, and they are a beautiful airplane. They make a great sound, and they're a great airplane to fly. And then I always liked the F-86.
Why?
I don't know. It was the first swept-wing jet fighter. It could exceed the speed of sound in a vertical dive. Wide open throttle, just barely, but it could. And it was a beautiful airplane, and it had no bad tricks. Never surprised you, and I just loved that airplane. Then the newest airplane I got to fly, a lot of times the newer airplanes are the ones you like to fly, but in more recent times now, they, airplanes are flown by the computer, and you put the software in it, and that determines the flight characteristics of the airplane. So almost all of the new airplanes fly very nicely, just as far as going out and having fun and stuff like that. And besides that, they have all the new bells and whistles, you know, for weapons and stuff. So after I retired, the Air Force invited me to fly in the front seat of an F-15 Eagle two-place. And that was a special thrill. That thing has got so much thrust. It's almost more than the pilot can stand, or an old pilot can stand anyway. So the F-15 Eagle is my other favorite, because I haven't flown anything newer than that.
Right. When you were 18 months shy of retiring, you had the opportunity to go to the Pentagon and fly a desk before you retired, and you passed it up and volunteered to go to Southeast Asia, and did, and commanded the tactical fighter wing of F-105s. Why did you do that, and what did your friends say about your decision?
Oh, you don't have that exactly right, but it's close.
Well, that straightened me out then.
I got assigned to the Pentagon, and I didn't want to go there because I had a short time. I was close to mandatory retirement of 30 years. And if I went there, I knew that that's where I would be, and I would die right there. And I'd been to the Pentagon before, and I volunteered for Korea to get out of that one. And so when I got there, I had the opportunity. I wasn't really promotable. I didn't have any, you know, if they promoted me, I would not be retained. And so I was just filling time. And they said, hey, we got a requirement for someone in Southeast Asia. You have to be have been a wing commander, and they have to be checked out in the equipment, combat ready. And of course, I filled the bill with the F-105 from being stationed in Okinawa. And while I was in Okinawa, I thought, surely I'll go to Southeast Asia. But there's only so many rooms for colonels, you know, and so, no, I'm going to the Pentagon. Well, anyway, this opportunity came up, and I said, shoot, I think I'll volunteer. And I talked to Ellie about it, and she was pretty supportive of me, believe it or not. And I don't know, what are we in the Air Force for? To fly and fight. And so I decided to go.
When you were there, your son Jim, oh, To Fly and Fight, sound a bad title for a book, maybe. Your son Jim?
Oh yeah.
Aviator, Air Force officer, aviator flying, what, the O-2, O-2A? What was he flying?
Yeah, the O-2, he was in special operations.
Right.
I know what you're getting to.
So you want to just go there without me saying anything?
He feeds me a few lines and then I've got to pick it up. This is a story about father and son flying a combat mission together. And he went to the Air Force Academy, graduated in 69, and his first duty assignment, well, after flight school, his first duty assignment was to Vietnam, and he went to Special Operations Squadron in Benoit, and I was in the Pentagon, and I made this switch, and so then I go to Thailand, and so we're over there together, same time frame, and I had this all the wing commanders were called into 7th Air Force in Saigon. And so I called my son and I said, hey, I'm going to be in South Vietnam on such and such days. Any probability that we could get together? So he says, yeah, come on down. So I went a day extra. I flew an F-105 in and landed at the other base, Tunsinut, near our headquarters, and gave him a call on the phone. And I said, hey, I came a day early. How about we get somehow or other we get together? The bases are pretty close. And he says, how would you like to go on a combat mission with me? And I said, what? He says, how do you want to go on a combat mission with me? And I says, well, sure. He says, well, stand by. You know, now he's a new head. He's a brand new second lieutenant. He hasn't been there 6 months. And he comes back, and God, it seemed like less than a minute. He says, all set. He said, I'm coming over there on an O-2, pick you up, bring you back over here. We'll spend the night. In the morning, I'll have you back there for your mission, and we'll fly for my briefing, but we'll fly a mission on the day before. So sure enough, that's what happens. And he was in a special ops squadron. And I don't know if you know the configuration of an O-2. It's a push-pull. It's a Cessna 337. Has a push-pull engine and a boom tail. Well, the Air Force modified them, called them the O-2A. And they had a little seat in the back. And on these special operations airplanes, they had a little compartment, almost like a bomb bay, you might say, but very small. So the mission he picked for us to go on, they had speakers out on the wingtips like this, and they'd go over these strong communist strongholds and propaganda, broadcast propaganda for, you know, so many minutes. And then we'd come by and drop the surrender leaflets or the safe passage leaflets. So normally you've got an aircraft commander, which could be a second lieutenant or a captain or a major or something, and then a kicker, which was usually a three-striper. And he'd sit over here and he'd work the radios. And then when it came time to drop out the leaflets, he would do that. So in this case, you got a brand new second lieutenant and you got an old full hurdle as a kicker. And we go out and they had done this for years. I could make this sound real hazardous, but they knew exactly where to fly, how high to fly. You could see them down there shooting AK-47s at us. And we'd go over like that when we were running around and come back and made a pass over. So, oh, DK Dad, just throw out the leaflets. And I leaned over and my favorite knife flipped out of my flight suit and went sailing down into the jungle, followed by lots of leaflets. Anyway, you know, words can't describe the emotions you go through flying on a mission with your own son, a combat mission. But my late wife, Ellie, had a few words to say about it. She was damn glad she didn't know about it until it was all over.
Jack, how much do we owe as a country to this airplane and people like Bud?
Well, the airplane itself came as a result of the mobilization of the U.S. industry. You know, we made not only airplanes that won the war, we made ships and tanks and trucks and ducks. I know they had in Branson, Missouri, they had a World War II duck that sank and killed some people the other day, but those ducks were a big part of the invasions that they had, not only in Europe, but also in the South Pacific as well. So we had the military, had the industrial complex stoking the providing the bullets and the guns, and then you had a group or a generation of self-sacrifice and motivated youth that were able to go carry the fight it was a world war on two engagements, one in the South Pacific and the other, of course, in Europe. And I know my dad, I was born the day after Jimmy Doolittle went into Tokyo. If he'd have been on schedule, if the fishing boat hadn't seen him, I'd have been born on the day he went in. But I was born the day after he went in. But the self-sacrificing mindset that that generation of young people had was unbelievable. I know my dad worked in a engine factory in Cincinnati, Ohio, and he didn't get his papers to be in the Navy until 43. It was almost, the war was 2 years going when he got in. And he told my mother, he said, you know, he said, I could get a deferment, because I've got, my boss told me, you give me a deferment because I'm working on this engine factory that made engines for the B-29, as it turned out. And he said, but I'm not doing it, I'm going to war. And I know he had one brother, his brother had asthma, and he couldn't go because of his asthma, and I know that bothered him his whole life.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, Jack Roush and Colonel Bud Anderson.